Every time we give a talk here, we try and make Buddhism relevant to daily life, but also make it sometimes a little deeper to give some understanding on why all this works this way. And this evening, I'm going to be talking about praise and blame and how that relates to the Buddhist idea of non-self. In Buddhism, we have this very beautiful, but very profound, very deep idea of non-self. And it's very useful when it comes to such things as praise and blame. Because from praise and blame, you also get things like pride or lack of self-esteem. And lack of self-esteem cripples a person's energies and hope in this world. Sometimes it even leads to depression. And depression even to suicide. All because of too much blame. And praise is also something we should really learn to understand. And how does that all work with the Buddhist teaching of anatta? Who are you praising? Who are you blaming? One of the core teachings which I'm going to bring up today, I mentioned it to my monastery last Wednesday. One of the core teachings concerns a little simile, and the one which really one should bear in mind very often. It's a simile for modern life. It's a simile of the two children in a supermarket. You've many of you heard this before, but I'm going to expand upon this at length in this discourse today. Two children in a supermarket, and they're in the checkout lane, one next to the other, parallel lanes, and one child, carrying a jar of honey, drops it on the ground. The other one in the other lane has a carton of milk, and drops that too, and that spill smashes all over the floor. And the mother of the child who drops the honey says, "You stupid child." And the mother of the child who dropped the milk said, "That's a stupid thing you've done." Now, there's a world of difference between those two responses to an act of stupidity in life. One is actually criticizes the child. Says the child is stupid, as if the child will be stupid for life. "You stupid child." And the other one criticizes the act. "That was a stupid thing which you did." And you can see the difference in that. One is condemned to be stupid for life. The other one sees the act, and that's a stupid act, but they're not a stupid person. When we actually start to understand the meaning behind that, we can understand the place of criticism in this world and the way that we can criticize husbands, wife, kids, people who work for us. I can criticize the monks sitting next to me, but you criticize them in a wise way, in a way which just never criticizes a person but criticizes the act. "That was a silly thing you did, monk. That was a stupid thing you did, husband." But, husband, you're never stupid. You disagree with me? I got a few people nodding their head there. No. That doesn't apply to my husband. He always does stupid things. Now, the point is here, when that happens to you, how do you feel? If someone actually said at work, "You know, that's a stupid, you're stupid," how does that feel? And when they say that's a stupid thing you've done, how does that feel? There's a whole lot of difference there, because one is just putting you down, giving you a sense of self and destroying it, that's you, and the other one is just seeing the act, what the person did or failed to do. And that is such huge consequences in many parts of our life. One of the places where it has huge consequences, where I started telling the story first of all, was in prisons, when I used to teach in prison. Because in prisons, what do we call people who are in jail? We call them criminals, or cons, or crims. I like the word cons, and that's one of the, you know, for convicts, short for convicts. Because one of the monks was telling me he went down to Karna Prison Farm last week, and I think they wanted to photocopy something for him. And said he got photocopies, no, CDs. CD players in prison, MP3 players they've got there. I said, "What are you doing with MP3 CD players in jail?" And the prisoner replied, "Mod cons for mod cons." And then modern convicts have got modern conveniences, and so even they have those there these days. But when I was visiting prison, I would never call them criminals. Because if you're saying criminals, it's exactly the same as if you call that boy who dropped the honey, you stupid child. Instead, I would say, you're a person who's done a criminal act. Just like the child who dropped the milk, you have done a stupid thing. And there is a world of difference between being a criminal and being a person who has done a criminal act. If you call a person a criminal, then they become a criminal and they always reoffend afterwards. If you say you've done a criminal act, the person realizes that that is not them, that is not the whole being, that is not their self, they don't identify with that, they don't become that, therefore they have a chance of changing. Now that happens in jail. I was very proud of this. I don't mind repeating it. It was one of my most heartfelt compliments which I've received in my life as a monk. When one of the prison officers at Carnet Prison Farm, I used to go up there most of all because it was just down the road from my monastery, gave me a call and said, can you come back? Can you come back and teach the prisoners? And I said, oh, I'm too busy, I'm an abbot now. And he said that, I've noticed, I've been in this jail a long time, all of the prisoners which went to your meditation class never came back. Other prisoners did. Meditation, those sorts of attitude actually stopped them coming back to jail. I spent a lot of time in jail teaching those prisoners. So much time in jail, I kept a record of the hours I spent in jail. So if ever I got put inside for something I didn't do, I got credit. I could not offer my sentence. I said, I've already done so many hours in jail. But nevertheless, it worked. And you can see that works not just with criminals. That can work in your life. Especially, I focus on relationships with husbands and wives. How many times do you break up a relationship, boyfriend, girlfriend, husbands and wife, because you focus on the person rather than the act? Husband, you're a stupid person. Wife, you know, you don't care. It's not that the wife doesn't care. They've done an uncaring thing. Or the husband has done an insensitive act. They're not an insensitive person. Because in Buddhism, what is insensitive? What is caring? What part of their body is sort of loving or angry? I mention this because it's one of their party tricks. Whenever somebody's angry, whenever you're angry, and you are angry sometimes, try and point to the angry. What is angry? Is it your nose which is angry? Or is it your sort of, you know, stomach which is angry? Is it your brain which is angry? What is angry? You can't point to angry. You are not angry. It's just a phenomena which happens in your brain, in your body or whatever. It's just a passing cloud on your life. But if you take that to be you, I am the angry person, it's amazing just how you become angry all the time. Just like the criminal keeps on reoffending. This is a psychology of how we make a self out of our actions, where we should just leave them as actions and not attach to them, not make a self out of them, not make our personality out of them. And this is where praise and blame coincide, or rather the end of praise and blame coincide with understanding non-self. You ask when somebody praises you, who are they praising? When they ask, who are they blaming, who are they criticizing, who are they criticizing? I've been trying to find out for years. Can't find who they're praising, who they're blaming. It's really strange sometimes that I do some things and I get praised for it. And I think, I did a stupid thing and people praise me for it. And then I do something really, really praiseworthy. I really work hard and I get blamed for it. Doesn't that happen to you as well? You can't win in this life. You really, 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 really try hard to do something good and people blame me for it. You know, I've been sort of really being kind because, you know, as a monk, people come and feed me. And, you know, they come all that way down to my monastery in Serpentine to give me this food or give me that food. And they try and make the very best. And I eat it all. And what happens? People blame me. They say, Ajahn Brahm, you're getting too fat. It's not fat. I'm trying to be compassionate. They blame me for this. And I'm trying to be let go of concern. So I don't watch my weight. Other people watch my weight. Weight Watchers. as they say, you try to get into shape. You know, a nice round shape. But whatever it is, sort of, and sometimes you really try hard to do something good. And, you know, you do, like, do some meditation. And people say, oh, you know, you're just sort of being, you know, copping out. Recently, I went to Singapore for a few days, you know, to help people out there. You know, try and do something good, help other people. And then you get criticized, oh, you're bad in the monastery, you should be here more. So I stay over here and I get blamed by Singaporeans. Oh, you should come around and see us more. So whatever it is, praise and blame, praise and blame. What is it, praise and blame? Who are they praising? Who are they blaming? When you look at it, those actions which you do, the speech which you do, how do you know it's worthy of blame? How do you know it's worthy of praise? How can you blame anybody when you don't really understand what they did, why they did it, and all of the stuff which was going in their mind before they acted in that way? I always recall one of my friends from school days, one of my oldest of friends. When he was a school teacher, he was a school teacher in the London borough of Wandsworth. That's a really, really rough area where he was teaching in, and he got some really tough kids there. Now, it's a government school, so they had no choice. He told me that when they had troublesome children, they would ring up the next school in Brixton, which was also a very bad area, and they'd do swaps. You know, we'll swap our terrorist for your terrorist. And that's the only way to do it, because once you get this, you know, really awful gangster in the school and he goes to another school, it takes him about 6 months to impose himself on the gangs in that school. So for those 6 months, he's nice and quiet. That's how they worked. But they were in this very, very rough school. And he told me that this kid came in one morning, you know, into class and spat on the floor just between the teacher's feet. They spat. And my friend said, clean that up. And the kid looked at him and said, F off. You know, the full words. You know, I'm a monk, so I'm very restrained, sort of. And so he had to go up to the headmaster. Well, I think they had a sort of a disciplinarian in the school. And half an hour later, the vice principal or whoever it was to the discipline came with his arm around this kid and said, didn't you know, to my teacher friend, didn't you know that his mother and father had a big argument last night? I think the father sort of beat up the mother and the mother left to go to a refuge. That's why he's crying this morning. The poor, my friend the teacher said, I'm a teacher, I've got 30 kids in the class. You haven't got time to find out why. When he found out why the child had done that, it's inexcusable, it shouldn't do that, but sometimes when you find out why people do it, it makes your whole response to the situation completely different. How can we blame someone? How can we praise anybody? You know, when you praise someone, they've done something good. You don't know, they may have had a really good education, have really nice parents, you know, have a really good sort of spiritual foundation by coming to Dhammaloka Buddhist Centre every Friday night. What do we expect? You know, they are going to be good people, aren't they? So sometimes when you praise somebody, what are you really praising anyway? Sometimes when I look about praise and blame of another person, I just can't do it. How can you praise another person when you think of all the stuff they've been through, all the stuff they've been doing? How can you blame them? Because praising and blaming is just judging, that's all. Some years ago, I was coming up to Nolamara for the weekend. We were going up the Tonkin Highway, and our van stopped on a red light. And you know the Tonkin Highway is in a double-lane highway. There was another car stopped just next to us. And I looked through the window, it must have been on that side because I never drive on the other side. I looked through the window and this man was swearing at the traffic lights. And you can actually, you know, hear him through the window. You bloody traffic lights, you knew I was in a rush. You let the car in front through, but you stopped for me. And it's not the first time you've done this. You've done this every time on this journey today. And he was swearing at the traffic lights. And it's a very good example, because traffic lights haven't got a consciousness. They're anatta, non-self. They don't do it on purpose. It's not as if the traffic lights is looking out for you. and they spot you coming, and they know you're in a hurry, and they let you know what it's like. They just, on yellow, they let the car in front of you turn red for you, just for you, teach you a lesson. And that's what he was thinking, that the traffic lights had done this on purpose. Have you ever got angry at traffic lights? I've seen monks get angry at the sewing machine. I saw this monk once, because we, you know, had to sew our own robes, and the needle kept breaking. And he was actually banging, "It's so stupid, sewing machine, you stupid sewing machine." Do you know the, what was that, a classic sketch in Fawlty Towers? You know, I'm not supposed to watch TV, but I did watch Fawlty Towers. You know, for one reason, I watched two episodes of Fawlty Towers, because, you know, the waiter in Fawlty Towers, Manuel, because I went to school with him, he's not from Barcelona, he's from Chiswick. Andy Sachs, I know him. So I went to school, and I want to find out what he was up to, why it was so funny. But anyway, on the episode which I saw, I think Basil Fawlty's car stopped or something, and he just had an important appointment, and he ended up beating it with a stick, thrashing it. "I warned you, car, this would happen to you if you stopped." And it's a classic sketch, because it shows we could hate and get angry at a machine. So if you can get angry and you can blame a machine, certainly you can blame your husband, and it's not his fault. He's just a machine. Condition, that's what he does. What do you expect? Because sometimes, you know, you go, "Oh, your husband's late for some sort of appointment." And you know you wanted to go to the Buddha Center this evening. It's not the first time your husband is late. He does this all the time. In the same way that you can get angry at a traffic light just for being a traffic light, you can get angry at a husband or a wife or a child or a monk or whatever, because a monk is just being a monk. When you actually see you can get angry at traffic lights for no logical reason, how much of your anger to the people you live with, the blaming of them, is really justified? You don't know what they've been through, why they've done that. So when you blame or praise others, it's judging others, and judging others, you just can't do that. "I don't have enough information to judge any of you. I don't know what you've been doing, why you did this, where you came from, all the forces, the disappointments, the pain which you've been through. It's hard enough for me to judge myself. To give myself a score for this." Maybe we should do that, just like in the Olympics. You know, have these little cards, they give a score after the talk, you know, 5, 4, 9. How can you judge all these things? You don't know what I've been doing all day. And when you stop judging, then all this praise and blame business start to sort of disintegrate. You can't judge, praise or blame yourself. You can judge an act, one act. "I did a stupid thing. I shouldn't have said that." Fair enough. But you can't judge the person. When you can't judge the person, you can't judge yourself. How on earth can there be such a thing as lack of self-esteem? How can there ever be a big ego? How can everyone say, "I am so great. I'm the best monk in the whole of Nolamara. Oh, I'm the best monk in the whole of Perth. Oh, I'm the best monk in the whole of the world. I'm the best monk in the whole of the universe." You can't do that anymore, because you never judge anymore. A lot of judging, a lot of praise and blame, is what builds up this sense of self in you. And this sense of self and praise and blame causes a heap of trouble. If you've been abused in the past, had a hard upbringing, a lot of that blame is to yourself. Judging yourself for being maybe unworthy, judging yourself as not really having anything worthy of respect. You've made a self, and a very unpleasant self to live with. If everything's gone well for you, being successful, sometimes people get so arrogant. And again, they just built up this self, which again is going to cause them heaps of problems. When you just think, "I've just done a few good acts, I've been a lucky person," then you never judge yourself. If you have a good time, You know the thing that you are a good person. You don't have to keep on making sure that each act is a good act. You don't take your happiness for granted when you don't have a big ego. Nor do you take... Taking happiness for granted is think, I'm happy, I don't have to do anything more. This is it. I can relax, enjoy myself. You find that happiness disappears. You're building a permanent self. When you get abused and depressed, again, that's also building a permanent self. It's taking your pain for granted. By which I mean you think, because it's been painful so far, it's going to be painful for the rest of my life. Because I think I'm a criminal, I have to be a criminal for the rest of my life. Because my mother called me stupid, therefore I am stupid. Believing that is where we make this self. We assume that the praise and blame of others is justified, and therefore we accept it. When people do blame you or they praise you, please be mindful enough. Remember, they're not blaming or praising you. They're just blaming or praising an act which you did, which isn't you, which is a passing phenomenon, certainly. You've done many good things, many bad things. You've made mistakes, but you've also done good things as well. When you see all of that, you can't know who you are in that sense. You don't take the past for granted. You don't allow the past to define you. And then you're free. If you had abuse in the past, when you let go of that self-blame, then you are free from that past. You've forgiven it. To forgive it means letting it go, not accumulating it in your mind as me. Because this is what we mean in the Buddhist idea of a self. When you tell you like a self, a me, who are you? A lot of times we're the accumulation of all of our experience of the past. We're the sum total of our acts and our experiences. And that's what we take ourselves to be. I am the person who got a degree. I am the person who came from the United States. I am the person who worked hard to make my money. I am the person who's a failure. It means you're just summing up what you've done so far, thinking that's you. When you do that, you become a prisoner of your past. You become a prisoner of your blame. That's called lack of self-esteem, depression. Or you become a prisoner of your praise, which is called being arrogant. In Buddhism, we have this beautiful teaching, which is close to the idea of self, called the three conceits. In the West, being conceited is always thinking, I'm better than you. In Buddhism, that's only a third of conceit. The other two-thirds are, I'm worse than you, or I'm the same as you. Those are the three types of conceit. I am better, I am worse, or I am the same. They call them conceits because each one is judging, comparing. It's comparing things which just cannot be compared. How can you compare yourself with anybody else? It's like going to a school and praising the year 12s because they know so much more than the year 1s who are stupid. You can't say that. It's just the year 12s have been in school longer than the year 1. Sooner or later, the year 1s will be the year 12s. And then sooner or later, the year 12s will be the year 1s again when they get reincarnated. So it all goes round and round. But whatever, you can't... How can you compare these things? It's when we compare things, that's when we start to praise. That's when we start to judge. That's when we can get anger, ill will from. Or we get hatred from. So when we stop comparing, stop judging, then all this praise and blame business starts to disappear. And the three conceits go. We can't say, I am the same, I am worse, I am better. All we can say is, each one of us is different. Remember that wonderful piece of wisdom from the life of Brian? When they asked, you know that movie? When they asked Brian, please tell us something wise, profound. And he said, you are all different. And the big crowd underneath the balcony said, we are all different in harmony. So, the truth is, I mean, you are all different and you can't compare yourself to anyone else. But how often do you compare yourself with somebody else? And how often does that cause so much suffering? When you compare yourself to someone better, you want to sort of reach up to their heights. When you compare yourself to the rich guy next door, you want to be as rich as they are. When the monks compare themselves to the wise monks, they want to be as wise as somebody else. I want to be as smart as the guy next to me. It's called, sometimes in Buddhism, we want to be as enlightened as the person next to us. We want to sit as long as they do. You see some monks or some lay people, they sit so still. And we want to sit just like they do. Some monks have got psychic powers. We want to get those psychic powers too. Some people get enlightened. We want to be enlightened too. It's called spiritual materialism. And it needs to be really understood what spiritual materialism is. Sometimes you see that. Actually, I was guilty of spiritual materialism this afternoon because I think there's a visiting Swami. I think Swami, Ravi Shankar or something. I was coming back from the plane on Wednesday and he was on the same plane with me. But he was sitting up in first class. And I was in a club. He's not a real Swami. I'm the real Swami. Swamis are supposed to be humble. And then I thought, I've lost spiritual materialism. Ajahn Brahm is trying to go one up, keeping up with the Joneses. That's what spiritual materialism is. I'm more holy than he is because I went in economy and he went up in first class. Really, it was just jealousy, that's all. But you can see the spiritual materialism as well. And where's that all coming from? From comparing, from measuring. And the point here with this praise and blame business, with anatta, is how can you measure? What standard are you measuring you against anybody else? Is it really fair? A lot of times you find you can't measure anymore. You can't compare yourself to any other being in this universe, no more than you can compare one tree to another tree. Every tree has got its value in. On my monastery, the small trees are as important as the medium trees, as important as the big trees. Those ones which are really straight, maybe nice for timber, but nowhere near as beautiful as the ones which are all over the place and leaning this way and leaning that way and gnarled. So the old trees are wonderful. The middle-aged trees are just so strong. The young trees are so full of hope. How can we judge between them? We judge in our society, don't we? Young people, they're the heroes. They're the people you see on the TV. They're the people you see in the magazines. You never see a picture of an old person with grey hair and sort of broken teeth on the front of Vogue magazine. You never see them reading out the news. But really, they're valued just as well. Why are we measuring people? When you are measured like that, when you're measured, how does it feel? As a woman, how does it feel when you start getting pimples? As a man, how does it feel when you start losing your hair? What's it like when you have to go and have false teeth for the first time? When you realise you're getting old? People keep saying that life begins at 40. That's what they used to say when I was young. And then it went up to life begins at 50. Now I hear people saying life begins at 60. That 80 is the new 40. It's crazy speak what people say. Why not just enjoy getting old? Why measure the worth of a person according to their age? How can you do that? It doesn't make any sense to me. How can you measure a person according to their physical beauty? How can you measure a person according to their wealth? How can you measure a person according to their wisdom? You can't measure the person. All you can do is measure their act. If a person is kind, I don't matter what gender they are, what age they are, I don't matter what race they are, or religion they are. If they're a kind person, I love them as a friend. If they're a wise person, or rather if they do a wise thing, then they can be my friend. Now you can understand you're not really judging the person, you're judging the acts. And so this is actually how you can look at yourself. When you look at yourself, you don't judge yourself as I'm hopeless, I'm terrible, I'm useless, I'm ugly. You've had an ugly morning, that's all. Was it called a bad hair day? I don't have bad hair days. It isn't. This is one of the good advantages of having a bald head.
But when you don't judge yourself, you don't measure yourself against other people, can you not see the freedom which you have? The peace which you have? A lot of our problems, human being problems, is always trying to please others. Some people spend their life trying to live up to the measurements of others. When you were young, you were trying to live up to the measurements and the hopes of your parents. When you're sort of going out looking for boys, girls, you try to live up to the measurements of what you thought was attractive. And then you become married and you live up to the expectations of your partner. And then when you get old, you're trying to live up to the expectations so you can go to heaven afterwards. It's always trying to live up to something, trying to please someone. If you're not trying to please your husband, it's trying to please some God. My goodness, so much pressure on life. If you're not trying to please those beings, you're trying to please yourself. Wouldn't it be wonderful just to let go of all of that and just be yourself instead of having this pressure on you of trying to live up to something? What are you trying to live up to? You know that when I became a monk, you had this ideal of what a monk should be. You know, I had this ideal of a monk just sitting in a remote cave somewhere, in a remote monastery, just so wise, never speaking. Just when anyone would ask you a deep question, you just smile enigmatically. Unfortunately, I couldn't get away with that. I tried very hard many times. You know some of my cave stories. You know, this time when I was in this monastery in the north of Thailand and I got so fed up with all these people coming to ask me questions. Because I was the only Western monk in this monastery in the north of Thailand, and they would ask me the most stupid of questions. What they would ask, keep asking me, is what country you come from? And as soon as I said England, do you know the Beatles? And how many brothers and sisters have you got? And it was just really boring questions. So after enjoying that for a couple of hours, when I had a break, I think I told him I was going to the toilet so I can rush away. I did go to the toilet, but that wasn't the main reason. I was just trying to escape from them. And so I escaped back into my hut, and I grabbed very quickly a bottle, a flashlight, and a mat to sit on. And I went into one of the caves. In this monastery, we had lots and lots of caves because it was limestone hills in the north of Thailand, the foothills of the Himalayas, close to the border with Burma. And I ducked into one of the deepest of caves. It must have been about 100 metres, maybe 150 metres long. So winding passageways this way, that way. And I went to the very, very end where no one would find me. Put my mat down, bottle of water, turned off my flashlight. I could meditate. I'd escaped. I felt so happy that I could be a real monk again for about 10 minutes. That's all they gave me, 10 minutes. Because I'd heard a noise, someone was walking towards me in this passages of the caves. So I opened my eyes, and even though there's lots of bends, I could see like a light sort of growing brighter and brighter at the end of the little passage where I was. Somebody was coming with the lanterns. And then I kept my eyes open, and then I saw someone's head poke around the corner. One of the Thai men's head broke around the corner. And they put the head away around the corner again very, very quickly. And because I listened to them, what they were saying next. And they say, there's a ghost at the end of the cave. That's what they said. I said, no, there can't be a ghost. Really? Yeah, a real ghost at the end of the cave. And then they were discussing what they should do, where they should all run away. But then two of them put their head, just their heads, not the rest of the body, around the corner. I said, no, it's not a ghost, it's a Western monk. No, it's the ghost. And then the three of them pulled their head around. It's the Western monk. I'd have been much happier if they thought I was a ghost, because then they would have left me alone. So about 8 or 9 Thais, they'd also got bored. They decided to explore the caves. They should have been listening to the sermon by the head monk. Actually, so should I, but I wasn't. So they came along there, and they came up in front of me. And as soon as they came up in front of me, they started to ask, what country are you from? Do you know the Beatles? And so at that point, you sort of give up.
So you don't have an ideal of what a monk is supposed to be. Well, you have sort of an ideal, but you try and live up to it. But you're much more living up to being yourself. You know that I've been in this business, this monk business, for so many years. And sometimes you get up here and give a talk. And those monks, you know, who know me very well, many of you who know me very well, this is just who I am. I don't put on a show for when I'm in front of a microphone. Because you don't try and please anybody. If you try and please someone, trying to live up to some ideal, try and measure yourself up to some ideal, trying to be somebody, trying to seek praise from other people, then I would never be able to survive as a monk. It'd be just too hard. There'd be too much pressure on me, too much stress. So I just relax and enjoy myself. When I took over from the previous abbot about 10 years ago now, 9 years ago, oh no, 10 years ago, I thought to myself, there's only two possibilities. Either I turn out to be a good teacher and then people like it and they come here and many people come. But if that doesn't happen, then I can be a hermit. And that's even better. Whatever happens, I'm not afraid. I'm just going off on a tangent here because I only recently came back from Singapore. And coming back from Singapore, the sniffer dogs were out again, sniffing us all. And I remembered, it brought into my memory, the last time the sniffer dogs came out was when I was just returning from Sri Lanka. I'd gone off to Sri Lanka to do a little meditation retreat. And on the way back at Perth Airport, waiting in the line for the immigration, you know, the big queues they have in the immigration counters in Perth Airport, they're really, really slow. Out from a side door, one of the customs officers came dragging a sniffer dog sniffing for drugs. And they went up and down the line. You know what it's like when you get a sniffer dog coming up? Even though you haven't got anything, you know, people are so relieved when a sniffer dog passes by. But when it came to me, it didn't pass by, did it? It put its nose in my robe. And this is a real story. The customs officer had to drag it away. It was wagging its tail ferociously. And at that, I could see the person standing in front of me. He sort of moved a step further away. The person sitting behind me moved up. They weren't with this bloke. He moved a step further back. And they went down the line again. And of course, people were looking at me by this time. But before I actually got to the immigration sort of counter, they brought the dog out again. Two times, up and down the line, sniffing people, going right past, came to me again. Same thing happened. Nose in the robe, wagging its tail violently, and had to pull it away. And people were really looking at me now. But I was completely relaxed. I had no worry in the world. So I'd been to jail before. I'd visited there and been taught. Oh, you get 3 meals there. And you watch the TV and the beds in jail are much more comfortable in my monastery. So I didn't care. If I go to jail, it's more comfy. You don't have to do all this work, you know, talking about people's problems. Maybe. So anyway, just when I went to the customs, of course, come over here. They're coming up through your stuff. And one of the nice things about being a monk is you don't have much belongings. A few stuff, a little bowl and a bag, and that's what I travel with. And so I only took about 5 minutes to go through it all. And so, you know, what have you got, you know, underneath? It's very easy to, because a robe, you've got no buttons or zip, you just open it and have a look. Easy. So I don't need a strip search. So they could actually see I wasn't carrying anything. And they said, okay, where, you know, first of all, they said, where are the drugs? I say, no, I don't have drugs at all. And so I proved it because I opened up everything. And said, well, why did that dog stop twice just at you? He questioned us. I said, no, because monks have loving kindness. And I started explaining about metta to him. And as soon as he said, get out of here. The best way of getting free from the customs officials is trying to convert them. Yeah. But the point of the whole story was, because I was completely relaxed, I didn't care what happened, because you weren't judging yourself, you weren't trying to live up to somebody's expectations, you were relaxed, that's how you sort of at peace with such incidents. If you thought, oh, what are people going to think about me?
You know, they think I'm a drug addict. Or what are people going to think about me? What are they going to say about me if I go to jail? I see how much what we think other people think of us, other people's praise and blame, just controls our life. How many women worry about your appearance because you're worried what other people think of you? How many men worry what other people think of you? And what a pressure that is on your life. Isn't it wonderful just to relax and what other people think of me, that's their business. They can't tell who I am. How can they judge me? How can they measure me? They just do not know the problems and difficulties, the pain, the pressures. They don't know my history. How can they judge? Then you become free of the prison of the comments of other people. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You can just be yourself and enjoy yourself as you are, rather than worrying what other people think of you. They can criticize you. They can blame you. They can call you all sorts of names. Who cares? Why allow other people to control your happiness? Why allow a few words, a few criticisms to make you, to spoil your day? I refuse to allow what other people say to me to make me unhappy. I absolutely refuse. And many times being a monk, wearing these funny clothes, people do say funny things to you. Why didn't you get a proper job, you bludger? You know, when there was a Superman movies were on, that was one of the best comments I got. Someone saw me and said, "Superman." I thought that was actually quite a compliment, really. Yeah. You know, you've got a robe, you've got like a cape like Batman. Anyway, so there's no need to worry what other people think of you. Now, if you can do that, what your husband or your wife says about you, if you don't worry what they say about you, they can call you camel face, they can call you pig face, whatever they call you. If you don't get worried about it, they'll stop calling you those names. They only call you names to get a negative reaction because they want to control your happiness for one reason or another. If you refuse to allow other people to control your happiness, people stop calling you names. It's a waste of time. Those kids in school who get bullied, if people call you names, it's laugh. Don't ever allow other people to control your happiness. If they call you names, they criticize you, they blame you, they call you stupid, they call you an idiot, whatever it is, the only reason why we do get upset is when we believe they may be right. Well, otherwise, why would you get upset when someone calls you an idiot? Because you think they may be right. But if you know they're wrong, then it's the end of the problem. They're wrong. I'm not an idiot. So you just got it wrong. And I'm not going to care what you say. You're no judge and jury who knows, who's competent to know me. So that way the blame doesn't stick. And when blame doesn't stick, where we don't receive blame, then people will stop blaming us. They'll stop criticizing us. When they stop criticizing us, when they stop blaming us, then maybe we may stop blaming ourselves and criticizing ourselves. Just, I'm not going to even allow my stupid thoughts to control my happiness. I can't judge myself, and I'm not going to judge myself. I'm not going to measure myself. How can I measure myself? How can I sort of say whether I'm a good monk or a bad monk, or, you know, sort of a wise monk or not so wise monk? I'm just going to be a peaceful monk. I'm going to enjoy myself. That's enough. Now I think you're getting some understanding about praise and blame and how to overcome that. Too many people in our society suffer from depression, lack of self-esteem, lack of confidence. Why have you got lack of confidence? Because you're afraid. What are the people going to think about you? What are they going to say about you? Why is it that after all these talks, we give the opportunity, any questions? You've all got lots of questions. Now, you talk about them on the way home, but you don't ask them now. Why is that? Because you think, what are people going to think about me? Because of that lack of confidence, because of that lack of that fear of what other people are going to say about us, you can see how that cripples us in our life. finding a partner in life. Sometimes we don't speak to each other from our hearts because we're afraid, what's he going to say if I say this? What's she going to think of me if I do that? Can't we just relax and be ourselves? Certainly that, you know, I learned confidence as a young man. And it's actually one of the reasons why when I go and speak to youth groups. I spoke to one of the youth groups in Singapore when I was out over there this last week. When you're talking to a youth group, when you're teaching Buddhism to young people, you got to talk to what they're interested in to make it relevant to their lifestyle. So what were the youth in Singapore concerned about? The boys were concerned about girls, and the girls were concerned about boys, basically. Actually, about 90% all they were concerned about. So I decided to teach them mindfulness on how to chat up a girl. It's Buddhist Dharma, make it relevant to people. And I sort of used to tell the story that if I was a monk chatting up girls, you know, many of you have had that experience. A boy comes up to you if you're a girl, or as a boy, you plan what you're going to say. Because you're afraid of what she might think of you, you get all nervous and you blow it. You say stupid things. I did that many, many times as a young man. And I decided that's not the right way. So I decided I'm going to relax. I'm going to enjoy myself. I don't care what she thinks of me. And then when you do that, you relax, you're confident, you're just having a good time, you're mindful, but not mindful of what other people think of you, you relax, you come across as confident. And that really, really works. So I was teaching the boys how to pick up girls. And I was teaching the girls using Buddhist principles how to keep their boyfriends. You've got to be mindfulness, find out what he likes, be sensitive. Because that mindfulness and sensitivity is listening. Really fully listening. Same with the boys as well. So this is the way that I was teaching. That's okay. This is the way I was teaching people how these Buddhist values actually apply in daily life, make it relevant to people. And in particular here about praise and blame, one of the big problems in Western societies, in Australia, in Perth, depression, lack of self-esteem, lack of confidence, not being able to communicate with one another. Why is that? Because we're just too concerned what other people think of us. We're too concerned about praise and blame. We're too concerned about measuring. Too concerned what we look like, how we come across, rather than just relaxing and being, not ourselves, but being no self. Allowing yourself to do stupid things, but never thinking you're stupid. Allowing yourself to make mistakes, but not thinking that you are a mistake. That way, we become free. An immense burden of pain and suffering is taken away from us. It's as if like we've been in a prison of praise and blame, and always seeking praise and always being afraid of blame, always being a prisoner of criticism. And now we're free. We're not measured by anybody. We're not measuring ourselves. We're just being ourselves and enjoying it. If you're ugly, you're enjoying being ugly. If you're old, you're enjoying being old. If you're whatever else it is, you're enjoying who you are, making the most out of it, instead of trying to be somebody else. A lot of problems is trying to be somebody else. And you don't really know who you are yet. And you're always trying to be someone different. Why don't you just let go and be yourself? And you find you're not half as bad as you think you are. When you really relax and let go, you're confident, you're at peace, you're happy because you haven't got the stress and the pain of trying to be someone else and not liking yourself. You can leave your husband. You can divorce your wife. You can leave your job and change your job. You can even move to another country. But you can't get away from you. You are stuck with you for the rest of your life. And actually, in Buddhism, you're stuck with you for many more lives as well. You can get away from everyone else, but you can't get away from you. Understanding that profound truth
you are stuck with you for many, many more lives. You might as well sort of deal with the problem of not liking yourself, sometimes hating yourself, being depressed, even some people who commit suicide. We don't believe in suicide in Buddhism. It just doesn't work. When you kill yourself, you're still there afterwards. So it doesn't work. That's why we don't believe in it. So whatever happens when you do these things, it's not solving the problem. It just gets rid of the body. It's like a person with a sort of driving along with a sore foot. And they sort of throw away the car. They've still got the sore foot. Because the pain is not in the body. The pain is in the mind. Killing the body just gets rid of the body. It doesn't get rid of the mind. If you're depressed and you kill yourself, you're even more depressed afterwards. You can't do anything right. Can't even get rid of depression right. So when you understand you've got to live with yourself for a long time, at least get this lack of self-esteem under control. At least get rid of all this self-criticism, self-hatred, anger towards yourself. My goodness, why can't you be at peace with yourself? To love yourself. To love yourself does not mean liking yourself. That's praise, liking yourself. Loving yourself is accepting yourself. The door of my heart's open to me, no matter who I am, no matter what I do. Unconditional, not measuring. Not praising and blaming and trying to live up to something. The door of my heart's open to me, no matter what I've ever done, no matter what I ever do. So this is not making what you do as yourself. There can be stupid things or wise things which you do. Love is independent of that. Accepting yourself in spite of your stupid actions and your wise actions. Seeing a self beyond that. All those things which you do and say, they're not you. They're stupid acts, but you're not a stupid person. Loving kindness, door of my heart's open to me, no matter who I am, that's learning how to be at peace with yourself. Not liking yourself, not hating yourself, being at peace with yourself. It doesn't fit with any of those three conceits. I am better, I am worse, I am the same. You're not measuring yourself at all. Just accepting yourself, however you are. And that is perhaps the biggest goal of life. Coming home, being at peace with yourself, getting beyond all praise and blame, or measuring or criticism. When you do make a mistake, it's just the act which makes a mistake, not you. So, that's all you're getting today. So, whether you like it, you don't like it, I don't care. Now, I'm going to see how many people understood my talk, see if there's any questions. Who's got the nerve, the lack of self-measuring, to ask the first question? Are you afraid what people are going to think of you when you ask a question? Very good. Great. That is a stupid question. But it doesn't mean you're a stupid person. Thank you very much. Yeah. It's always worth praising things which are worthy of praise, encouraging them, but be careful, because sometimes people become addicted to praise, they always want praise, and sometimes they can't get praise, and they feel upset. And sometimes if we get addicted to praise, that is also becomes a bit of a burden for us. Because, you know, in a relationship, you know, when you first fall in love, you're praised every day. But, you know, after a few months, you know, the praise tends to wither away. If you become addicted to praise and think that's necessary for your relationship, you're getting in trouble. So there's the addiction to praise as well. And after a while, you know, you think, what are they really praising me for? Maybe for children, to give them a sort of an encouragement in life. But isn't it more wonderful just to praise you, not because you did a wonderful picture, just praise you for who you are.
Otherwise, it's only the top kids in the class get praise. And the other ones don't get anything at all. So I think encouragement is good, but I think encouragement is, to be fair, encourage everybody. You know that story when I was a school teacher. And of course, there has to be one child comes bottom of the class. So, you know, I saw after giving out the results in maths, I was a maths teacher, this poor little boy, and I got the results, he was bottom, 30th, I think it was 30 in the class, 30th in the class, and he looked so despondent and depressed. And I was a compassionate teacher, so I went up to him and said, look, I know you've come bottom in the class, but what you've done is a wonderful act of self-sacrifice, because someone has to come bottom of the class. And you've taken an awful position this year, so no one else has to suffer. In Buddhism, we call it a bodhisattva, someone who gives up their own happiness for other people. And so you're the hero, you're like the martyr, you've taken that terrible position so no one else has to suffer. So it's a wonderful thing you've done. Yeah, you deserve a medal, I said. And this little boy looked upon me as if I was crazy. He was probably right. But when I said that, it just broke his depression. He laughed. And okay, you know, he was bottom that year, but next year he did much better. And it was somebody else's turn next year to make the heroic sacrifice. So I like doing stupid things like that, just to turn it around so that people don't get into this praise and blame business. Someone's going to come bottom, someone's going to come top. Does that really mean they're worthy of praise or worthy of blame? Sometimes, see. The guy might have had a bad day when he was doing the sums that day. May have just been a bit tired or not feeling well. So when you stop a lot of praise and blame, especially when people grow up, encourage, maybe encourage yourself, but encourage yourself to be peaceful, to be free. You don't need to be a great success in life. And what is a success anyway? Look at me. I haven't got a penny to my name. As far as the world is concerned, I'm a complete failure. I haven't got any superannuation even. Don't know what Mr. Costello thinks about me. Anyway, thank you for that question. So thank you for those great questions. I shouldn't actually say great, should I? I've been praising you now. Thanks for those questions. Anyway, so now we can have the announcements to sum up for this evening. I know that I'll make the one announcement about there's an ordination on Sunday at my monastery. One of the novices is going to become a monk. So anyone who hasn't seen how you make monks, the ceremony, that's going to be held at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine around about 12:15 on Sunday. And the person who's becoming a monk is sitting next to me. So Benedita is going to become a full monk, and his parents are here. His mum and his friends are here today. So thank you to the parents for coming. I think they listened to the talk today. I hope they like it. And he's going to become the monk tomorrow. This is his one chance for stardom. And then for the next 10 years, he's just the ordinary monk at the end of the line. So that's on Sunday. Okay, other announcements.